From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar, and this week we speak with Dr. Gerald Horn, the noted author, historian, and educator. By the way, he's also a lawyer. And we discussed the global economic and political situation and also some considerable discussion of the domestic political situation. We began in the South China Sea.
Well, the G20 meeting taking place as we speak in China is quite striking. Both the Washington Post and the New York Times have highlighted the difficulty that President Barack Obama had just after he landed his plane, with almost physical confrontations between the U.S. authorities and the Chinese authorities. The New York Times interpreted this as China throwing its weight around, no longer willing to hide its light under a basket or bide its time and flexing its muscles. In my opinion, it represents a deeper fissure between the two nations, a fissure that will become all the more apparent when China and Russia engage in military maneuvers in the South China Sea within a few days. The South China Sea has been a focal point in terms of the confrontation between the United States and China in recent years. And it's also quite striking that the New York Times suggests that if the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership is not passed during the lame duck session in December after the U.S. presidential elections, this is the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement that excludes China and is being touted as by the U.S. administration as a way to keep China from gaining altitude in terms of what appears to be its inexorable rise. What's striking is that not only that Donald J. Trump and Hillary Rodham Clinton and Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, have come out against the TPP, but according to the New York Times, apparently there is difficulty in seeing it passing, even during the lame duck. And this is being cast by the mainstream press as a damaging blow to the U.S. attempts to corral and contain China. It's really quite remarkable. And in that context, of course, you have the fact that the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague just a few months ago ruled in favor of Philippines in terms of its confrontation with China about islands claimed by both nations. This too is in the context of President Duterte, sometimes known as Duterte Harry, on the one hand extending an olive branch to China and seemingly indicating that he was willing to bargain away Philippines' rights to these islands in return for Chinese investment. And it should also be said that President Duterte has agreed with China that this is solely a bilateral matter, that it should not be put in the context of ASEAN or the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Certainly, it should not be put in the context of a big power confrontation between the United States and China, with the Philippines basically being a pawn. This is quite striking that President Duterte has taken this position, because we know that the United States has paid handsomely to try to revive its military bases in the Philippines, which is part of the encirclement maneuver of China, an encirclement maneuver that also includes the United States military forces in northern Australia, also U.S. overtures to Vietnam. And also, you might have noted that just after the 2012 presidential elections that led to Mr. Obama garnering a second term, he took off almost immediately from Myanmar. And of course, the de facto leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, will be coming to Washington rather shortly, and this after a visit to China, which was hailed on both sides as being a positive development. In any case, as we step back and try to get a view of the larger picture, I think it's past time to acknowledge that A, Richard M. Nixon's overtures to China 4 decades ago, which has been touted by the U.S. mainstream as some sort of stroke of genius, insofar as it helped to enlist Beijing in the anti-Soviet encirclement, which helped to contribute in part to the downfall of the Soviet Union in 1991. But the price paid was rather heavy. The price paid was massive inward foreign direct investment to China, which has created this economic juggernaut that does not seem to be coming to any sort of halt anytime soon, and bids fair to change the international correlation of forces in a way not favorable to the United States. In fact, you see this by the very fact that the G20, the group of 20 nations, is meeting in China as we speak. The G20, in many ways, has supplanted and surpassed the group of seven headed by the United States, including the North Atlantic nations and Japan. And the very fact that the G20 had to be called into being and is now meeting in China is an indication of which way the global winds are blowing.
You know, I think to provide really some context, we invoke both geography and history here. The geography, the relevant part of it, in my view, is the fact that all of the big power confrontation context to this takes place in the South China Sea and around China's periphery, and Russia's for that matter, as opposed to an argument, say, over the Aleutian Islands or even, let's say, Block Island off of Rhode Island here. This is entirely, the outer perimeter of the empire rather than it being, you know, close American interests. And then the history, I mean, you have this court in The Hague making decisions about the rights of Asian powers with respect to Asian islands. That, to me, almost goes back to the Pope divvying up the New World back in, 500 years ago or so. And the Western courts have also seen this accusation with respect to their dealings with Africa, and China is certainly treating it that way. The irony also, the historical irony, what you just invoked about the history of the relationship with China since Richard Nixon, is that now you have China and Russia almost driven together by American foreign policy.
Well, that latter point needs to be focused on. One of the dicta of former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who is seen as something of a guru, believe it or not, and a wise man with regard to U.S. foreign policy, Hillary Rodham Clinton bragged during the debates with Bernie Sanders that she considered him to be an advisor to her, which, of course, Senator Sanders struck back rather forcefully with regard to that cockamamie notion of Henry Kissinger being a wise man and a counselor and a guru. But one point that he did make was that a strategic objective of U.S. imperialism would be to have the United States have better relations with Russia and China than they have with each other. And during the administration of President Barack Obama, that idea no longer obtains, as evidenced not only by the frequent meetings between President Xi and President Putin, but also, as noted, by their military maneuvers in the South China Sea in a few days, which is a decided rebuff and rebuke to U.S. imperialism. Now, certainly, President Barack Obama started his administration, you may recall, with the so-called reset with Russia. That is to say that relations with Moscow were going to improve, which would facilitate the pivot towards Asia or the more direct confrontation with China. But that particular maneuver did not achieve liftoff, in no small part because of the confrontation over the Crimea in February 2014, which led to a significant downturn in Washington-Moscow relations. And I think that that episode will bear investigation by historians and scholars in the future, assuming, of course, that climate change does not overcome us all, because I think what it illustrates is that the neocons, I know that in the past you've made reference to Victoria Nuland, the top U.S. diplomat in that part of the world, who, of course, was rather hawkish and, of course, has a very close relationship, shall we say, to Robert Kagan, who in some ways is the godfather of neoconservatism. And the neoconservatives have not been reconciled to some basic facts of politics. One basic fact of politics is that from the point of view of the more sober-minded elements in crafting the strategy of U.S. imperialism, the reset to Russia made sense. But to the neocons, who seem to have a particular itch to scratch when it comes to confronting Russia, this was a cast-down gauntlet. And so we saw that U.S. strategy in Eastern Europe basically blew up in February 2014, leading to a significant downturn in relations with Russia, with NATO creeping ever closer to the borders of Russia, and Russia in turn increasing its already close embrace to China. Now, those who are listening as we speak might ask themselves, what's up with this? Well, I think part of the problem is that, once again, it's a problem of geography. Russia is the land bridge between the richest continent, which is Europe, and the most populous continent, and the continent of the future, which is Asia. And, of course, it's a storehouse of natural resources, not least oil and natural gas, and gold, too, I might add. And there's always been this idea in the upper strata of U.S. imperialism that global domination perforce meant dominating Russia. Now, during the misadministration of Boris Yeltsin, Putin's predecessor, that particular strategy seemed to be working out swimmingly. But since February 2014, there has been an abrupt break or downturn in U.S.-Russian relations, which has led now to this present crisis of U.S. imperialism.
And you know, just for some background to that, although things certainly came to a head, above board between the U.S. and Russia over the, starting with the coup in Ukraine, or leading up to it even, they started with some rhetorical exchanges. And obviously, the revelation of the Nuland's conversation with Pyatt showed that the U.S. was acting aggressively at that time. But you also had the ongoing enlargement of NATO throughout the period, and in addition to that, which you cited, and in addition to that, the change in position from the vote on Libya to the vote on Syria with both Russia and China at the UN Security Council, where they essentially blocked the U.S. effort to do to Syria what they had already done to Libya, or were in the process of doing to Libya at that time.
Well, you are correct. Libya also was a turning point, because I think not only did Russia and China feel burned by the United Nations vote on Libya, but also many Africans felt burned too. Recall that the government of Jacob Zuma in South Africa in many ways went along in one of its major catastrophes with this brigandage that took place on the part of NATO in Syria. Not only the overthrow of the government, but the liquidation of the leader, Muammar Gaddafi. And it's clear that they intended the same approach in Syria, despite the fact that we know that in the wake of the overthrow of Gaddafi, Libya has been a kind of playground for religious zealots of various stripes. It's apparent now that the strategy of U.S. imperialism is basically stop us before we kill again. That is to say that they're going to do the same thing in Syria that they pulled off spectacularly in Libya, that is to say, helping to bring religious zealots to power, despite the fact that we're repeatedly told that religious zealotry, as exemplified by ISIS, is public enemy number one. Now, I think that in order to unravel what seems to be difficult to fathom, you have to understand that U.S. imperialism oftentimes feels that these religious zealots, despite their unpleasantness and their tendency to behead hostages, can be an ally. Certainly, that's the story from Afghanistan in the 1980s. Certainly, when you look at Russia, which has a population of 150 million, but an Islamic population of about 15%, and the ongoing conflicts that take place in places like Chechnya, there's this idea that religious zealots can be quite useful with regard to regime change in Moscow. The same holds true for China, which in Western China has a Muslim population of no small numbers. And so that leads to what appears to be difficult to fathom in Syria. I mean, for example, you just had the spectacle of Turkey, which had undergone this failed coup on July 15th. And of course, Ankara is pointing the finger of accusation in part at its erstwhile ally in Washington. Recall the rather chilly reception that Vice President Joseph Biden received in Turkey when he arrived there just days ago. And that has led to Turkey invading northern Syria, supposedly because it's trying to keep Syrian Kurds who are allied with Washington from establishing a foothold that will lead to some kind of regional autonomy for Syrian Kurds, which then could be a point of attraction for Turkish Kurds, who the Ankara regime sees as a major antagonist. But what's striking is, according to sources, after the Turks swept into northern Syria and ousted forces from certain cities there, allegedly and apparently in league with the so-called Free Syrian Army, which Washington has smiled upon itself in recent years. But according to certain sources, the Free Syrian Army forces, allegedly and apparently, as they were termed, were actually ISIS forces who sort of doffed their Free Syrian Army uniforms and put on ISIS uniforms. This, of course, has not received significant attention in the usually somnolent mainstream U.S. press. But what it bespeaks is a larger, more diabolical strategy, not only pursued by Turkey, but also pursued by its erstwhile ally in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, there was great discussion of the apparent U.S. strategy of allowing ISIS to march through Syria, and basically that as it moved, it would get steered by a bombing campaign by the West so it would go in the direction that it wanted, which was essentially against the forces of the Syrian government. And there are others that say that the, with some overlap, that the Free Syrian Army is really a figment of Washington's imagination for public relations purposes, and that the forces are indistinguishable from ISIS to al-Nusra and others except among themselves.
Well, yes, that is a fair point. But once again, it bespeaks a number of points. One, the apparent inability of the U.S. mainstream press to keep its eye on the ball. And in that context, I should mention that there's a certain incoherence of the major mainstream press organs in the United States today. On the one hand, particularly as reflected in the New York Times and the Washington Post, there's this holy crusade against Donald J. Trump, which I understand to a degree. They've gone so far as to suggest that Donald J. Trump is a neo-fascist and that the United States will have hell to pay if somehow he's sworn in as U.S. president in January 2017. But on the other hand, if you look at the U.S. press and how they cover the world and how they push right-wing causes globally, they're helping to pave the way for the rise of a Donald J. Trump. They don't necessarily see the connection between their domestic strategy and their global strategy. I mean, for example, look at their cheerleading against President Maduro in Venezuela. Now, if President Maduro, heaven forfend, is dislodged, that will be a significant victory for the right wing. When President de Kirchner was dislodged in Argentina, certainly the vulture funds on Wall Street had reason to celebrate, but that was a victory for the right wing. When you create this right wing momentum globally, inevitably there is blowback, to coin a phrase, in the United States of America. But apparently the U.S. ruling elite cannot see that intimate connection, which in many ways paves the way for the rise and the strengthening and the fortification of the right in the United States itself, which they tell us they're not in favor of.
You know, people have been talking for decades in any event, Paul Robeson, Du Bois, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, about the connection, I guess that could be summed up with imperialism abroad, white supremacy at home, or imperialism abroad and more generic colonialism at home, the relationship between foreign policy and domestic policy in strictly generic terms. And yet that's very rarely discussed these days.
Well, not only is it not rarely discussed, but when you invoke the names of these iconic figures like Robeson and Du Bois and King and Malcolm X, it also reminds us as well of other kinds of contradictions in the U.S. ruling elite. I mean, for example, just yesterday in the New York Times, there was an article about the Star Spangled Banner. And as I'm sure listeners to us as we speak know, the third stanza of the Star Spangled Banner explicitly and directly calls for gloom and doom to be visited upon the black population of the United States of America. Now, it's quite remarkable. Some might even say astonishing if they're not aware of the outline of U.S. history for a national anthem to target a particular segment of the citizenry. Right. Indeed, if you understand the third stanza of the national anthem, you may be able to understand this tremendous and spectacular spate of police killings inflicted by officers of the state against black people in recent months and years. What's even more striking in that context is those who are supposedly are against big government and government intruding into the lives of the populace don't have a whispering word to say about government executing its citizens without due process of law. Now, this New York Times article also was rather illustrative because it quoted some academic who really doesn't know what he's talking about, saying that these words written by Francis Scott Key, the lyricist of the Star Spangled Banner, a slave owner, by the way, a man who was directly involved in pogroms against the black population of the D.C. Baltimore area in the first few decades of the 19th century. Supposedly, the words that he penned are not targeting the black population, despite the clear meaning of those lyrics. They're targeting the British who were manipulating the black population. In other words, it's a throwback to the old idea that black people can't think for themselves, that they require outside agitators to tell them that they need to flee from slavery and need to attack their slave owners. Right. This is ludicrous. The fact that it was published in the New York Times just a day or so ago is even more astonishing, particularly since we are told that the New York Times and the mainstream, too, is opposed to these executions of black citizens. But what it reveals, of course, is that U.S. history and U.S. reality has to portray black people as dupes in order for U.S. reality and U.S. history to make sense. Because if you were to tell the truth, which is that the black citizens, or the black residents, I should say more accurately, of North America were hotly opposed to being enslaved, and even more hotly opposed to slave owners, and therefore during the War of 1812, which gave rise to the Star-Spangled Banner, did not hesitate to ally with the invaders against their masters, and that had been a persistent pattern of the history of North America, stretching back decades to the time when slavery was just taking off in the 17th century in North America, to the point during the War of 1812 where black people helped to burn down Washington, D.C., torch the White House, send President James Madison and his garrulous spouse, Dolly, fleeing into the streets, one step ahead of the posse, and then fled on British ships to Trinidad and Tobago, where their descendants continued to reside. However, you have to present a history of the United States that reconciles the present with the past. And if you portray black people as being hotly opposed to the U.S. state in the early 19th century, it becomes difficult to say why black people should continue to be hotly opposed to the state in 2016. That the mainstream and the U.S. ruling elite cannot abide, and so therefore they victimize black people doubly, if not triply, by portraying them as dupes of invading British forces, just like in the 1960s, they portrayed them as dupes of outside agitators.
Yeah, that's an old song, that particular one. With the issue of how black people felt with respect to the state in the 19th century and how they were willing to make alliance with Britain, which, by the way, of course, was no angel. It was in the process of constructing its imperial empire across the planet, well into that process, including in Africa. And they were no friends of the people that they were, in essence, enslaving, you know, domestically as well like that. However, strategically, it made perfect logical sense, and that flowed from the thesis that you've put out, you know, broadly and deeply about the nature of the American Revolution, basically as being one to protect slavery in the United States against the coming British emancipation or rejection of it.
Well, this also exposes the contradictions of even left discourse in the United States of America. I mean, black people, like oppressed people anywhere, have the choice between a dirty shirt and a dirtier shirt. That is to say, a dirty shirt of rapidly abolitionist London, or the dirtier shirt of Washington, which was deeply enmeshed and marinated in enslavement of Africans. Of course, they chose the dirty shirt over the dirtier shirt.
I thought,
of course,
you
the U.S. ruling class has done the same thing.
Let me just say, I thought you somehow snuck a sneak peek into my laundry here.
Oh, I see. Well, I mean, this is the ABCs of politics. I mean, in 1942, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the U.S. ruling class decided to ally with Stalin over Hitler. Now, as far as I can tell, the only people retrospectively who opposed that decision were your fellow journalist Patrick J. Buchanan and the former U.S. President Herbert Hoover. Others see that as a stroke of genius. I mean, and we talked about Richard M. Nixon and his alliance with Maoist China. Right. I mean, this is part of the real politics of politics. And it would be a shame and a sin to say that superpowers are allowed, even by their own left-wing movements, to make alliances with powers that may have a few skeletons in their closets, but that oppressed people, such as black people, are not allowed to do so. Once again, it bespeaks the point that I'm making, that the black presence in North America is an uncomfortable presence. And it even helps to flummox and bamboozle even those who think that they're on the right track.
You know, on that point, you've seen a reluctance, certainly at best an ambivalence on the part of the left in the United States to oppose American foreign policy in places like Iraq and Syria and Libya, to the extent of saying that they side with the government against the U.S. invasion because of the dirty hands, quote unquote, of the governments in those countries. You know, regardless of the merit of the characterization of those governments, this is a failure strategically. I think it's been demonstrated repeatedly.
Well, part of the problem in the United States, of course, is that the pro-Zionist, pro-Israel lobby has so much influence. Has so much influence not only on Capitol Hill and on Wall Street, but even in the black movement, even in the left-wing movement. And as a result, it becomes rather difficult for the U.S. progressive movement to stand tall with regard to the attack on Libya in 2011, because Gaddafi was seen as a foe of Israel and a foe of Zionism. Likewise, it becomes rather difficult to support the toppling of Saddam Hussein in 2003, although I should say in all fairness that tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands marched in the United States in the prelude to that disastrous invasion. But in any case, we see once again with regard to Syria, just a week or so ago in these times, the self-styled socialist publication out of Chicago had an article basically lauding the attempts to disrupt and dislodge the secular regime in Damascus, Syria, despite the fact that this could lead once again to a victory for religious zealotry. Of course, the writer could have talked, if the writer had been more forthright, about how religious zealot fighters who are trying to topple the Damascus-based regime oftentimes are treated in Israeli hospitals, that Israel is not particularly upset about the fact that their erstwhile antagonist in Damascus is now under siege, and then that leads to this kind of journalism in a so-called socialist publication which excoriates the left for not being more interventionist when it comes to toppling President al-Assad. Once again, we see that what is exposed and revealed is that the United States has a very powerful right-wing movement, a right-wing movement that even influences the left, and a right-wing movement which, of course, leads to contradictory stances, such as noted, supporting right-wing advance in Venezuela and Argentina, but supposedly opposing it when it comes to the U.S. presidency.
You know, there's an interesting contradiction nested within that one, too, with respect to exactly who is the right-wing movement in the United States, not the popular movement, but the structural aspects of it. When you have those members that were essentially the people Hillary Clinton spoke of as the right-wing conspiracy against her husband from the beginning of his career to this particular moment in 1998 when she invoked it, those people are now in her camp, supporting her campaign against Trump, who more or less evicted them from the Republican Party, or his supporters did. And now they are standing, the neocons, all of them, next to Hillary Clinton and pointing to Trump and labeling him as a fascist. And on foreign policy, there's a severe contradiction there when he says no more regime change, let's not have war with Russia and China, let's pull NATO back and make people pay for their own defense, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, the United States is going through quite a bit of flux right now politically, as evidenced by this presidential election. Part of the flux is evidenced by a rethinking of so-called globalization by people like former Secretary of the Treasury Lawrence Summers and Financial Times columnist Martin Wolf. I think that it's fair to say that when this term globalization was first trotted out, what its advocates in the ruling class actually meant was that the entire world would be bending the knee to U.S. imperialism. But alas, with the rise of China, things have not worked out very well. Alas, what has happened is that, as represented by the presidential campaigns of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, you have a lot of discontent expressed by the U.S. working class in various permutations about so-called globalization. There is a recognition that what these trade agreements have meant have been whipsawing labor abroad against labor at home to the detriment of both. And so now you see Summers and Wolf, amongst others, with the rise of Trump in particular, causing them to quake in their boots, are saying, believe it or not, that future trade agreements need to pay more attention, not just to the needs of transnational corporations, but believe it or not, to the environment or labor. What an idea. And what an idea coming from the likes of Summers and Trump to begin with. But it's not only that. You mentioned the Democrats and Hillary Rodham Clinton. Well, you noted her speech on the so-called alt-right in Reno, Nevada, just a few days ago, which got generally positive reviews. But I think what was neglected with regard to those who did not carefully inspect her remarks is that she tried to link the alt-right to Putin, right, and then to Trump. Right. I mean, right, this is remarkable, that kind of troika that she was trying to confront, which, of course, helps to elevate the idea that if she is elected, the neocons who are now in her camp will be pushing hard in the first 6 months of 2017 for a renewed confrontation with Moscow, which, of course, is one of the looniest ideas since Looney Tunes. It's something that could spell not only disaster and catastrophe, but in a worst-case scenario, could mean planetary extinction. But that's what we have when we're talking about the rise of Hillary Rodham Clinton. And one more point. The Wall Street Journal, which editorially, of course, is in the Murdoch camp and the Fox News camp, and therefore is reliably right-wing, but has expressed severe reservations about Donald J. Trump editorially, had a very interesting piece on Donald J. Trump's ties to organized crime in the September 2nd, I believe, Wall Street Journal, this past Friday. Of course, being involved in construction and casinos, right, New York City construction in particular, is difficult to avoid ties with organized crime. Of course, they went to some length to detail his ties to the Genovese crime family, Fat Tony Salerno, the Scarfo crime group in South Jersey, Philadelphia, etc. But I just happened to be reading a book by Stephen Ellis called This Present Darkness, A History of Organized Crime in Nigeria. And among other things, he points to the ties between the Clinton family and Nigerian organized crime, not only in terms of Chelsea Clinton's father-in-law, Edward Metsvinsny, who, of course, served a term in prison because of his ties to Nigerian fraudsters. I mean, those of you who in your email inboxes see these messages from Nigerian princes who want you to expose your bank details to them, you might want to point the finger of accusation at at Chelsea Clinton's father-in-law, who, of course, served a term in prison for bank fraud, wire fraud, mail fraud, etc. But not only that, but the Clinton Global Initiative received a pledge of a hefty, whopping $1 billion from one Gilbert Shagari, a Lebanese-Nigerian billionaire, who, according to this book, This Present Darkness, the fortune of that family is based upon drug dealing, heroin dealing more specifically, that stretches back decades. Now, I am not holding my breath to read such stories in the New York Times, although, to be fair, the LA Times has been carrying a number of stories about the rather unpleasant aspects of this Lebanese billionaire who I've just mentioned. I say all this to say that there's a deeper story involved in this 2016 presidential election. And I'm afraid to say that the U.S. ruling class might be in over its head with regard to trying to confront the current contradictions and complications of international politics. In short, we, all of us, are on a ship of fools, and the captain is headed to an iceberg and refuses to listen to the warnings and the blandishments of those who see it staring us in the face.
Yeah, even if someone threw an ice cube at his head to try to get his attention. You know, you made reference to the vote on Libya at the UN Security Council, where South Africa voted with the United States to authorize the no-fly zone. It was Resolution 1973. And there were two African countries that voted on that, the other being Nigeria. Now, this was Hillary Clinton's project, and she was the one that we're familiar with gloating at the conclusion of it with the murder of Gaddafi. I'm wondering if there was any influence there over Nigeria's government through that connection that you painted.
Well, once again, I know the journalism in the United States is falling up on hard times with the rise of the Internet. It's basically wrecked the advertising business of the New York Times and the Washington Post, giving them less revenue to support investigative journalism. But on the other hand, of course, the vacuum created has been filled by enterprises such as yours. But having said that, I think it's a major flaw that the ties between the Clintons and more unsavory elements in Nigeria, Africa's largest economy and Africa's most populous nation, have not been sufficiently explored. Now, for example, in This Present Darkness, the book by Stephen Ellis that I just made reference to, he also makes an attempt to tie Mark Rich. You recall Mark Rich, who was this filthy, wealthy billionaire who was involved in all sorts of illicit activities, married or at least having a close relationship with a woman who contributed handsomely to the Clintons' coffers. And as a result, he got a presidential pardon despite all of the nastiness that he was involved in. This, of course, helped to splatter the reputation of Eric Holder, who was then not U.S. Attorney General, but a leading official in the Justice Department, who was in hall before Congress, and he apologized for helping to fast-track the pardon of Mark Rich. Well, apparently Mark Rich also had connections to Nigerian oil. So there was a Nigerian connection there as well. Now, I'm not necessarily endorsing every statement and allegation in this book by Stephen Ellis. You might have recalled that he did an earlier book on South Africa where he tried to argue that Nelson Mandela in the 1960s, before his imprisonment, had been part of the Central Committee of the South African Communist Party. Now, of course, from my point of view, that's no sin. From Ellis's point of view, it was a point of indictment. And so you should keep that in mind when you evaluate his evidence with regard to Nigeria. Having said that, I think an enterprising journalist would do well to look at his footnotes and follow the story from there.
You know, that's an interesting point to make a short segue to a side discussion about this. It's like a corrupted mirror image, almost through the prism of four hits of blotter acid, of this new McCarthyism that has Putin as the head, essentially, of a vast right-wing conspiracy across the planet, where, you know, rather than it being the Red Scare, it's the Brown Scare or worse. And I'm wondering, first, are the American people politically prepared for that particular conceptual paradigm shift? And two, does that augur something about the likely foreign policy of the Clinton administration?
Well, certainly the answer to number two is obvious. Yes, it does. And once again, I think that a President Hillary Rodham Clinton will be engaged in a no-win confrontation with Russia and probably a no-win confrontation with China simultaneously, which seems to me to be a textbook definition of insanity. You mentioned this neo-McCarthyism of the Democrats. Well, look no further than the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, where the Putin administration was blamed for the email hack of the Democratic National Committee emails, which revealed this conspiracy against Bernie Sanders on the part of DNC chairperson Debbie Wasserman Schultz. President Putin, in a recent interview with Bloomberg, basically made an accurate point when he suggested that pointing the finger of accusation at Moscow helped to distract attention from what was actually newsworthy, which was that the Democratic primary, to a degree, was rigged by the elites in the DNC. But obviously it doesn't stop there. Just a day or two ago, the New York Times had a very lengthy story trying to suggest that Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, now in self-imposed exile, shall we say, at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, was in some ways working hand in glove with Moscow, and that these promised leaks about the DNC and the Clintons, which we're all awaiting with bated breath, is some sort of conspiracy between Assange and Putin. Now, there was hardly a shred of evidence to substantiate that far-reaching notion, but then again, I guess you do not necessarily need evidence if you control the newspaper of record in the United States of America.
You know, I'm thinking of writing model that's used. I forget the terminology, the terms of art for it. But this plot, storyline, where on occasion, say a TV series like Batman, for example, you have, you know, this arc enemy, that arc enemy, this evildoer, that evildoer. On occasion, you have a league of them all operating together. And, you know, Assange is enemy of the United States. Putin, enemy of the United States. Both bad guys for in one way or another. And now suddenly, of course, it follows that they're working together. U.S. foreign policy has demonized one country after another and has led, for example, to the situation that Russia and China find themselves in, an alliance, if nothing else, of necessity. And it's almost like when you watch some of the votes at the United Nations, like on Cuba for a decade or so, that they have thrown everyone out of the room to alienate them and find themselves alone in the room themselves.
Well, it's striking that you mentioned Cuba because, once again, in terms of the flaws and the malfeasance of the U.S. press, covering Cuba needs to be Exhibit A. Not least being the opening to Cuba engineered by Washington under President Obama. Now, this has been portrayed wrongly and inaccurately as some sort of charity or benevolence towards Havana. This, of course, befits the self-imposed image of U.S. imperialism, which it foists upon too many of its naive and credulous citizenry, seeing U.S. imperialism as being this force for good, as they say, in the world. But what the U.S. press did not say is that there has been tremendous advance by China in the so-called U.S. backyard, speaking of the Caribbean, speaking not only of Cuba, but also of the Bahamas. There has been substantial inward foreign direct investment from China into the Bahamas, right on the doorstep of South Florida. You might recall that, I believe it was June 2013, President Xi Jinping, before the Sunnyland Summit with President Obama in Southern California, met in Trinidad and Tobago with the CARICOM leaders, the Caribbean community leaders. And of course, he opened his wallet, and there has been substantial Chinese capital inflow into the Caribbean. And so when President Obama made his overtures to Havana, it was in that context. There was a real fear in Washington about a replay of the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962, which involved, as you know, an eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation between Moscow and Washington over this notion that Moscow had placed what the United States called offensive missiles, what the Cubans and the Soviets called defensive missiles, in Cuba. The missiles were eventually pulled out, and as you know, quietly, missiles were pulled out of Turkey that Moscow saw as threatening the Soviet Union. But in any case, once again, the Obama administration was trying to not be overtaken by events by making this overture to Havana. And once again, that important aspect of the story was left on the cutting room floor, helping to convince the already substantial percentage of the U.S. population that is all too credulous that Washington was engaged in a so-called force for good act on behalf of poor little Cuba.
You know, China's movement into the Americas has, you mentioned the banking in the Bahamas, for example. For people that aren't familiar with it, that's a very large offshore banking center, and with China bringing a lot of money in there, certainly some folks might be concerned that they might end up buying it and it becoming a Chinese banking center in that geographic location. You have the actual infrastructural investment that China's been making or is in the process of making in Nicaragua, deep ports in a variety of places that would carry traffic coming from the canal that would be built through Nicaragua. You have a transcontinental railroad in South America linking the Atlantic and Pacific almost. And a number of other, you know, there's a lot of manufacturing already done by China in the Americas. And that sort of coincided, the growth of that coincided with the proliferation of center-left and leftist governments in the region and the rising solidarity over the concept of national sovereignty. That's been under attack for with some successes by the U.S. While they're making the approach to and the changing the relationship with Cuba, they're putting Venezuela on and the Venezuelan president on a list of threats to the national security of the United States. You had the coup, in essence, in Brazil, the loss in the election in Venezuela for the National Assembly, and also the loss of the presidency in Argentina, where there was and apparently will continue to be substantial Chinese investment. So they are moving in, and they're seeing some reversals and yet laying infrastructure for further development.
Well, this raises a larger, wider point that we should focus on, which is the present global correlation of forces and what it portends for the immediate future. For example, if you look at Brexit, the British exit from the European Union, June 23rd, 2016, it's a number of ways to look at that in terms of the interests of U.S. imperialism. On the one hand, you could see it as weakening U.S. imperialism because it seems to me that Brexit ultimately will be a blow to British imperialism. And in part, you see this in the fall of the pound. In part, you see this in the softening of the red-hot real estate market in London. And you see bankers and the finance sector in London, which is a major part of Britain's economy, now begin to look longingly towards other cities, such as Amsterdam, for example, which would be a real turnabout because the rise of Britain as a major force on planet Earth began in the 17th century with its defeat of Dutch imperialism, not least ousting the Dutch from what was then New Amsterdam, now New York, in 1664. Right. So now we've come full circle in 2016 with the possibility of Amsterdam replacing London as a financial center of choice. So you could see the weakening of British imperialism and also the rather, shall we say, ham-handed and ignorant foreign policy of Theresa May, the new British foreign minister, who doesn't seem to have a coherent foreign policy, doesn't seem to have an ability to grapple with the complexities of Brexit, which is further driving Britain into the ditch. So you could see that overall as a blow for Anglo-American imperialism, to coin a phrase. But on the other hand, Washington might be able to manipulate a weakened Britain against a European Union, against not only a European Union, but also even, in fact, against Russia itself, turning Britain into a kind of Cyprus, for example, which for decades now has been a base of subversion aimed at the Arab countries, aimed recently at Turkey, etc. And speaking of the financial sector raises another point. I was just reading another book called Lawfare, Law as a Weapon of War. And it goes into the fact of how U.S. regulatory agencies, such as the Department of Justice, Securities and Exchange Commission, etc., have been extracting billions of dollars in fines from Barclays Bank, from UBS, now VW, the German automobile manufacturer, is in the crosshairs. And of course, because of the apparent and I guess real hegemony of the U.S. dollar, penalizing corporations all over the world who try to do business with Iran during the era of high sanctions before the Joint Comprehensive Agreement of 2015. And the book goes into some detail about how these agencies have been a weapon of war that the United States has used to keep its so-called European allies in line. And it'll be interesting to see, with the blows to the financial sector in London and the weakening of Britain generally, what that's going to mean for that kind of strategy. Also, I should add that when Apple computer of Cupertino, California, comes under fire from the European Union trying to extract $14 billion from Apple's coffers, this could be seen fairly as the EU striking back. And similarly, with the impending collapse of the so-called transatlantic trade partnership, the companion to the TPP, a German cabinet minister basically announced it dead just a few days ago. This too was an effort for the EU and the US to unite against the rising specter of China. Now it's sprawling apparently in the ashes. But in any case, the apparent collapse of the transatlantic agreement could also be seen as a reflection of these growing conflicts and contradictions between the erstwhile European allies and Washington. I should also mention there's a particular New York State angle. You might recall the New York State official, Benjamin Lowsky, who was waging a sort of one-man war because of Wall Street being centered in New York City against competitors of U.S. financial institutions, to the point where the European press was calling him a Lowsky unto himself, so to speak. In any case, this book also goes into detail about the point that somehow had escaped me, that a few years ago, President George W. Bush delayed a trip to Switzerland for fear that he would be detained, not for war crimes, not unlike what happened to Augusto Pinochet of Chile, who was detained in London for weeks because of a request from a Spanish magistrate for the London authorities to hold him because of crimes committed by the Chilean dictatorship against Spanish nationals in Chile. I say all this to say that I think the movement in the United States is missing the boat with regard to this growing concept of universal jurisdiction. What I mean is that if Bush delays trips for fear of being detained, if Pinochet is detained in London because of crimes committed in Chile, and this is at the behest of a Spanish magistrate, what is keeping reparations activists in the United States of America from suing the U.S. authorities in a friendly foreign court, attaching and seizing U.S. property abroad, and converting that into reparations for the descendants of enslaved Africans? I mean, as to coin a phrase, what have you got to lose?
And I was thinking when you mentioned earlier the Chinese investment in the Bahamas and the stop of President Xi at the CARICOM conference, it made me remember that a cry for reparations, a strong one, has come out of CARICOM.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And so I guess what I'm saying is that we should take seriously the idea of a global village, and that the internet and supersonic transport have shrunk the world. And as Lawrence Summers and Martin Wolf of the Financial Times have suggested, globalization also has a downside for the U.S. ruling elite. And so in jujitsu fashion, we should be turning globalization back against our antagonists on Wall Street and in Washington.
Dr. Horn, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Thank you.
You've been listening to CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar, your host, and look forward to seeing you again next week.